Are you running?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Written and spoken, did you say?
Written and read.
Written and read. You say when then, right?
Yeah, we're running, when you're ready.
Adolf Hitler, My Partner's Downfall, written and read by Spike Milligan.
Here at Read On, we're always asking if you've found a hidden gem in the library or you've got a favourite book that you'd like to share. Well, I have some favourite books I'd like to share. When Red started to present Read On, I was a guest on that very first show with the books of my life. And some of the books of my life were Spike Milligan's war diaries.
September the 3rd, 1939. The last minutes of peace were ticking away. Father and I were watching Mother digging our air raid shelter. She's a great little woman, said Father, and getting smaller all the time, I added.
As well as being a very funny and a very subversive first-hand account of the Second World War, there are portraits of the formative years of the towering comic genius that was Spike Milligan. Let's look at the first book, Adolf Hitler, My Part in His Downfall. The first of his recollections of life in the army takes us from the outbreak of war in 1939 through his attempts to avoid enlistment and his gunner training in Bexhill, right up to the landing in Algiers in 1943.
One Saturday morning, while Mother was at church doing a bulk confession for the family, Father donned an old army uniform and proceeded to transform the parlour into HQ Combined Ops. Walls were covered in tatty maps. On the table was a 1927 map of Thomas Tilling's bus routes. Using wooden mushrooms as anti-tank guns, Uncle Willie placed them at various points on the map for the defence of Broccoli. My father told the early morning milkman that, he said, tapping the map, that is where they'll start the attack, on England. But that's Africa, said the puzzled milkman. Ah, yes, said Father, quick to recover, but that's where they start from, Africa. Understand? No, I don't, said the milkman, whereupon he was immediately nipped in the scrotum, thrown out, and his horse whipped into a gallop. Only 2 pints tomorrow, Father shouted after the disappearing cart.
Spike Milligan reading Adolf Hitler, My Part in His Downfall. But please note the RNIB version of that book is read by Stanley McGee. The War Diaries were really the first grown-up audiobooks I listened to, that big vinyl box of cassettes I would get from the library in Kilmarnock, the Dick Institute. And I think what made them stand out was you could sort of hear the edits, especially when Spike started to laugh or he messed up a line. And when I became a talking books engineer, it made me really sympathise with whoever was behind the glass recording those books all those years ago. Well, he joins me down the line. Robert Nicol, welcome to Read On.
Hi, Robert. Hi. I'm so pleased to hear that someone listened to the audio we did all those years ago. We used to get no feedback at all, funnily enough. Not like today, when I've just had a quick peep, see if the audio was still on sale. And I come across hundreds of 5-star reviews for something. It came as a bit of a surprise to me, really, to see that.
Yeah, something that was recorded 40-odd years ago.
Yeah. At the time, as you probably know, audiobooks went to libraries on cassette, and the client would make a maximum of 1,000 units, and then it's gone for history, never to be heard of again. When you rang out of the blue and jogged my memory about these recordings years ago, I thought, well, they'd all been deleted, they'd all gone, because it's something that used to annoy me a little bit, because all the recordings we did, and there's a lot of them, not necessarily Spike, but all kinds of, we did 13 Barbara Cartland books, which never really sold, but I mean, they're out there.
Unless someone has taken the time to digitise them.
Yes, I noticed that. I hope they've popped the credits on the back, who recorded it. I doubt it very much, though, because it was in the days of recording onto quarter-inch tape, and you'd have a reel of tape the size of a dinner plate on a tape recorder the size of a washing machine. I mean, that probably sounds pretty old-fashioned to the situation you're sitting in at this present moment. But, yes, and then what would happen is you'd put a reel of tape on the machine. Spike Milligan would be sitting in a little room opposite us through a glass window, and then we'd press record, and then you'd hope that he was going to read.
And he didn't always read.
Well, no, sometimes what was happening is, I think he was about 70 years old when we started working with him, and the first thing he told us was, I've had a triple heart bypass, and I'm taking these pills that dry your mouth out. That was one of the first things he said to us.
Disaster. Sergeant Dawson, Ackeye, That's the assistant instructor. Reporter the line to the gun position. Oh, start again. Can you hold the line a second?
Yeah.
I'm taking some tablets which dry your mouth up just to make life hell.
Yeah, right.
There. Sorry. Can you hold a second, please?
Yeah.
I'm drying up. He had a face made from red plasticine by a child of three. That's wrong.
We were very gentle with him because when you start an audiobook recording, the whole process, you're going to be stuck with someone underground in a room with someone for about 5 days, someone who you've never met before. So part of the process, the first part of the session, really is to sort of build a sort of a working confidence with the person and, you know, hopefully a friendly atmosphere. And this was actually quite hard with Spike because, you know, we were quite scared, to be quite honest, at the other side of the glass, because he had a bit of a reputation that sort of went before him. And so we just wanted to make sure we kept him there, really, and he didn't walk out on us.
And there were some days where he didn't turn up at all.
Yeah, there'd be a couple of times. I mean, one particular instance, he was being driven up from his home in Rye to our studio in North London. And we were sitting around drinking coffee, waiting for him. And it was not unusual for him to be sort of an hour late. But 2 hours in, we get a phone call to say, and this is not disrespectful on Spike, but pretty much anyone who's worked with him probably knows this happens. We had a phone call to say he's had a panic attack and they've turned around, they're going home. So, you know, there's not a lot we can do in a situation like that. So the recordings that are out there, not only were they recorded effectively line by line, they were recorded over a series of weeks when we could grab him, because at his age, you couldn't, normally with an audiobook, you'd get an actor in and you'd sit them down and you work with them until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You do a full day's recording, hoping to accomplish 3 hours of finished sound in those 6 hours. But with Spike, we had to adopt a whole new method. We would book him for a morning session or an afternoon session. And even then, sometimes you'd be 2 hours in, happily recording, and then suddenly he'd go, right, that's it now, lads, I'm off. And he'd put the book down and go, I'm just going to use the loo before I go. And we were sitting the other side of the glass thinking, well, you know, what do we do? And all we could do was go, yep, okay, yep, that's fine. We'll see you tomorrow, you know. Looking back on it, it was quite a scary, nerve-wracking time.
We marched through the palm-lined streets into a vast concrete football stadium. I must go now, lads.
Yeah?
I'll leave the book here for tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Can I use your loo, do you mind?
Now, the second book is Rommel, Gunner Who, A Confrontation in the Desert. The second volume in Milligan's war memoirs concentrates on his time in North Africa. This volume is more poignant than the first, but that's sort of inevitable, as the friends he made in book one are starting to be killed.
We passed the bomb-shattered village of Tukuba, full of booby traps. 7 sappers were killed during the clearing of it. Outside the village was our new position. At night, it looked like the surface of the moon, or Mae West's bum the moment her corsets came off. In front of us was a rocky, multi-surfaced outcrop, 80 feet high and 100 yards long. Behind us, a ledge dropping sheer 50 feet to a granite plateau 50 yards away. Then, another 30-foot drop into a deep valley. In fact, 2 giant steps. The canvas command post erected, I pitched my tent on the edge of the first drop, because shells falling behind me would drop 50 feet down, and I would avoid being subdivided by the Third Reich. However, if shells landed in front of me, I'd suffer the consequences. What?
Spike Milligan reading from Rommel, Gunner Who. Available from the RNIB, read by Spike Milligan in a double volume, with book number 3, Monty, His Part in My Victory. The third volume of Spike Milligan's account of life as a gunner in World War II resumes on the eve of victory in North Africa. Now Britain's looniest war hero must combat some of the direst threats a soldier has ever faced. Boredom, a cold, moving camp, relaxing on the beach, moving camp again, a visit to Carthage, and a perilous encounter. But against the odds, they survive, and they're sent at last to Italy to be killed.
It's all very exciting, said Kitchell. Wonder what they're going to do with us. But first, they're going to make us seasick. And when we are vomiting at our limit, land us on a beach in Italy under shellfire. The ramp is being winched up. Hello, we're off then. The engines throb into hard astern. We hear the ring of the ship's telegraph. We pull away from the jetty. We are all lining the railings. It's 6 o'clock as we pull into the middle of the Lac de Bizerta. Well, said Kijel, rubbing his hands with excitement, we're off at last, whereupon we drop an anchor. You were saying, I said.
I mentioned in the introduction that you can kind of hear the edits in the finished work because he was making himself laugh.
Oh, yes, yes. No, I mean, because it pre-digital, the way you used to edit was you would, on your reel of tape, you'd have a little wax crayon called a China graph, and you'd play the tape, and then you'd put a little mark on the back of the tape where a paragraph or a sentence started. And then you would play all the outtakes off where an outtake is where an actor restarts the sentence. And in Spike's cases, he wouldn't restart it once. Sometimes he would restart that sentence 10 times. And then the editor who's joining the tape together has to cut the tape with a razor blade, spool off, junk and throw away all the 10 mistakes, and then rejoin it up to a section of speech that's fluid, effectively, and says the proper words. Play the whole tape back. All those 10 mistakes have disappeared. And inevitably, he's going to come in with more energy, or he's going to come in with a slightly different voice. And in some cases, he changed the words. He changed the script. If you imagine this big reel of tape, the size of a dinner plate, would run for an hour long. So at the end of when Spike had gone home, you would take that reel of tape away and you would edit it to cut all the mistakes out. And that reel of tape would end up being less than 20 minutes long. So you would throw on the floor about 45 minutes of recorded mistakes. And then when you wound, when you wound that tape back through the machine, back to its beginning, all the little white sticky marks, they sounded like a machine gun fire going through the tape head. I mean, that again, unless you've actually heard a tape recorder rewind, you won't know what I'm talking about. But yes, or driving down a motorway, looking at all those little white lines passing beneath you at 70 miles an hour. That's what the Spike Milligan master tape looked like at the end of the day. But looking back on it, I do think I was actually very lucky to have worked with him and met him. And the funny thing is, often these things where you have to do a lot of editing, you capture a sort of energy, because actors who read at a slow and regular pace, who don't make many mistakes, are actually sometimes quite dull to listen to. But it's the readers who take risks. It might be a bit annoying when they come in at different volumes and you set the microphone up 8 inches in front of them, and by the time you've gone back into the control room, they've moved 2 foot away from it. Little things like that are sent to try us.
On moonlight nights, haystacks bore lovers through their primitive course. By day, there was shade aplenty. Oaks, horse chestnut. Hold the line. Stop it a second, would you? On moonlight nights, haystacks bore lovers through their primitive course. By day, there was shade aplenty. Oaks, horse chestnut. Chestnuts. Why can't I say chestnuts?
There's an outtake where we hear him complaining about the font sizes.
Yes, yes. That was the very first recording we met with him. And the voices you hear, I have the managing director of the publisher with me, because he'd come up to see the start of the first recording. John Green is the director who's communicating with Spike, and I'm quietly moving around, setting up microphones and trying to keep out of the way.
It's the print, you see. I'm totally having this problem. I would rather call it a day and go and get my copies of the book and come back tomorrow. I really would. It's starting to strain my eyes. I'm going to fall apart.
So, no, I was putting on about. We've got the bigger book. It's just arrived.
Hey?
It's here.
And what happened is we were told by his agent that he was going to bring a copy of the book in with him, which is quite normal for an author. You expect an author to turn up to the recording with a copy of the book. And, of course, what happened was he turned up to the studio with no copy of the book. So we organized some photocopies to come round. Luckily, his agent was probably about half a mile down the road in Bayswater, so we could get all these copies. But Spike did use it as a bit of an excuse to go, right, okay, I'm not going to do it now. My copy of the book isn't here. I can't remember exactly what he says. I think he says something about how much he pays his manager for mess-ups like this or something.
Yes, yeah. He doesn't say mess. Yeah.
But that was our first day with him. So you can imagine how we felt. We thought, oh, no, this is how it's going to go.
I pay my manager about £15,000 a year, like this.
There we are.
Now, we're going to need the others tomorrow. I asked her for all of them.
The only one she hasn't got is Rommel. But we're photocopying that and making it bigger.
I've got one at home. I'll do the whole job myself.
The other problem we used to have, and it was a problem with all actors, but particularly with Spike, was page turns. If you can imagine, he's sitting there reading from a book, and it's all right. If you're reading quietly in your head and you turn the page, no problem. But when you've got a microphone in front of you, that little rustle of paper creates a very big problem. It sounds like a thunderstorm or something. So at every bottom of the page, we would have to stop to allow Spike to turn the page and crease it and flatten it so it wouldn't move. And that caused a small problem when sentences ran over pages, because you'd have to get to the bottom of the page and then we would have to rehearse, and Spike would have to try and remember how the sentence continued on the next page before turning the page. And then we would stop, and all those little things had to be cut out, if you can imagine. Every little noise like that had to be cut out. So there are some edits in those recordings that today I would quite like to re-edit, to be quite honest.
The days were sunny but cool. Evenings were starry and cold.
Sorry, if you turn the page,
yeah,
can you say the evenings were starry and cold, having turned the page?
All right,
thanks, it will save us an edit.
How many edits are you saving for your old age?
Oh, quite a lot.
And were there many ad-libs as well?
Yes, and that caused us problems, because my contract with the publisher is to record unabridged, which means we record word for word, because sometimes, not Spike's recordings, but some of our other recordings are used in educational purposes, so it's important that the actor reads all the words that are on the page. But Spike would change the words, and when we used to stop him and say, Spike, sorry, you said that wrong, he would sometimes go, no, I've changed it.
I've changed it a bit. It's funnier.
I don't think it is funnier.
I do.
Oh.
I just got a lifetime award for comedy.
Pardon?
I've just had a lifetime award for comedy.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well,
that's why I was pulling rank.
Fine. I think you'd probably get away with it then.
And then he would tell us that he wrote the book, so it's within his rights to change it. We had no answer to. Again, there's so many things. And sometimes, because he hadn't looked at this material properly for 20 years, he would end up laughing. But he would start laughing before the punchline. So as he was reading a paragraph, you can hear his voice begin to giggle. And in the end, he would just have to stop and he would go, look, I'm sorry. This is just so funny. This is cracking me up. The recording was obviously bringing back lots of memories.
We had to separate them, but only after half an hour's intermittent fighting. Sometimes Hall and I would...
Spike, when you're ready... Go from sometimes.
Sometimes Hall and I would... I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Sorry. So I just... I'll go again. Oh. We had to separate them, but only after half an hour's intermittent fighting. Sometimes Hall and I would be... I'm so sorry. Just too much... I remember this incident. I remember it was yesterday. This dreadful fight with this little man.
Now, that's a point, actually, because halfway through the series of books, they take a bit of a dark turn, and especially in the second book when some of his friends start to die. Did that affect him as well?
Yeah. It's a job to tell if Spike was a bit miserable, because his default mode was misery. The only time you knew if he was happy was when he was chortling about, really. But yes, I mean, these things do, you know, you're drawing up stuff he probably didn't want to think about. But he wasn't a man necessary to express his moods to us, except if it was dissatisfaction, really. He was a very private man, really. The only time we ever saw a proper, real insight into Spike was when his agent, Norma Farnes, used to come into the studio. Because the two of them had a fantastic chemistry. And if he started playing around, she would say, come on, Spike, settle down, get on with it. Come on, Spike, you know, and she would treat him like a naughty child. And he responded really well to that. But that's a sort of a behaviour we couldn't adopt in the studio. We couldn't treat him like that.
I think you can do better than that, Spike.
Yeah, yeah. It was a full frontal. You could see. It was a full frontal. You could see everything. I'm sorry, I don't understand it.
I don't understand that either.
In book four of Spike Milligan's War Diaries, Mussolini, His Part in My Downfall, matters take a dark turn. It begins as he and his regiment land in sunny Italy in 1943. After a bout of sandfly fever, from which he soon recovers, our plucky hero is piddled on by a farm dog before forging his way inland towards the enemy and the sound of guns.
I'm holding a packet of woodbines, then there is a noise like thunder. It's right in my head. There's a high-pitched whistle in my ears. At first, I black out, and then I see red. I'm strangely dazed. I was on my front, and now I'm on my back. The red was opening my eyes straight into the sun. I know if I stay here, we'll all die. I start to scramble down the hill. Grump, grump, grump. They're shouting. I can't recall anything clearly. Next, I was at the bottom of the mountain. Next, I'm speaking to Major Jenkins. I'm crying. I don't know why. He's saying, get that wound rest. I said, what wound? I've been hit on the side of the right leg. Why did you come back? He's shouting at me and threatening me. I can't remember what I'm saying. He's saying, you could find your way back here, but you couldn't find your way to the OP. Next, I'm sitting in an ambulance and shaking. An orderly puts a blanket around my shoulders. I'm crying again. But why?
Mussolini, His Part in My Downfall is available from RNIB as read by Spike Milligan. I'm joined by Robert Nicol, who worked on all of those Spike Milligan books, and who also supplied the outtakes you're hearing from his own personal collection, which have never been heard in public before.
I'm first sitting, said Malloy, referring to his seating card. Good, I said. I was second sitting. Oh, why don't you change it to first, he said. No. I'll change it to second, I said. So while I waited, he did.
Hang on a minute. Doesn't he say, no, wait, I'll change?
I'm first sitting, said Malloy.
Yeah. Excuse me for being...
I'm trying to avoid sitting with him.
Yeah, I see, sorry. Excuse me for being dense.
Where shall I go from?
Could you go from I'm first sitting?
I got a nice cabin, he said. I waited for him to sell it. So sorry. Do you know if I wait there?
It's all right.
In the outtakes that we have, there are female voices in there as well.
Yes, I can tell you what happens is the first recording I think we did with Spike was Adolf Hitler, and I had a director called John Green. In the studio, if I paint a picture for you, you have the actor voiceover artist, Spike Milligan, one side, and on the other side, I'm the sound engineer who presses start on the record and also keeps my ear on the sound. And then I have a director. Now, the director's job is to have read the book to give the to help the artist give a proper interpretation on the read. Because sometimes, you know, if you might use the wrong voice, or you might need to slow down the read to give more feel to a particular part. And the director's job is to be that person, a bit like a conductor, you know, conducting an orchestra. The director conducts the voice artist. And I found very early on that if I put a woman director with Spike, my life was much easier. He responded so much better to being told what to do by a female than a male. So the voice you hear in the outtakes is a lady called Anne Rosenfeld, and she became like my babysitter to Spike. She looked after him and kept him happy. Spike responded much better to the female touch.
However, we were well served with red chianti. Amazing how wine transforms a meal. And that night, it transformed me. I was such fun, as Malloy told me next morning. Yes, he said, they put you to bed after you'd done the white elephant. Sorry, no. Yes, they put you to bed after you'd done the white-eared elephant. Sorry.
What is the white-eared elephant?
Well, it's a soldier trick. You open your fly and you pull your pockets inside out, That is supposed to be the white yellow.
Well, that's all gone on tape, thank you.
Yeah. And no. Did I do that? Yeah, not only that, but the early days of aviation.
All right, what's the early days of aviation?
These are soldier jokes. And you swing it around like this, like a propeller. That's early days of aviation. I shouldn't be giving all these soldier secrets away.
The fifth volume is Where Have All the Bullets Gone? By now, Spike has been dispatched from the front line to a psychiatric hospital, and from here to a rehabilitation camp. Considered loony and unfit to be killed in combat by either side, he becomes embroiled in his own private battle with melancholy. But it is music, wit, and a little help from his friends, including one gunner Harry Seacombe, that help carry him through to his first stage appearances.
It's a bleak, misty day with new added drizzle for extra torment. Mud. Mud. How did it climb up your body, over your hat, and back down onto your boots? The camp's official title is Rehabilitation Camp. Oxford Dictionary. Rehabilitation. Dealing with the restoration of the maimed and the unfit to a place in society. So now, I was maimed, unfit, and about to be restored to a place in society. The camp was a mixture of loonies and normals. One couldn't tell the difference, save during air raids, when the loonies dropped everything and ran screaming in the direction of away, crying, "Mummy!" Today, Mud and Mem were standing around in huddle groups or sitting in the tents with the flaps up. Our camp emblem should have been a dead hippopotamus. Sergeant Arnold's appeared to be running the camp. Into the ground, it appeared.
Spike Milligan reading from his war memoir, Where Have All the Bullets Gone? It's followed by Goodbye Soldier, in which our hero is doing very little soldiering, because it's 1946. Rather, he's now part of the Bill Hall Trio, a combined services entertainment inflicted on unsuspecting soldiers across Italy and Austria. And most of the book, he's largely preoccupied by the unbelievably beautiful ballerina, Miss Tony Fontana. But he must enjoy it while he can before he's demobbed and sent home to Catford. So he does.
I too have lost touch with my religion. I'd stopped going to church the moment I joined the regiment. No more could my mother nag me into God's presence. However, Tony was a practicing Catholic. Why are they always practicing? When do they become good enough not to? When I put that to Tony, she said, "I do not understand you. What are you talking about?" I said I was talking about 20 words a minute. She didn't understand, but laughed and said, "I love you, beautiful eyes." A strange, all these years in the army, and my sergeant had never said I had beautiful eyes.
Spike Milligan reading Goodbye Soldier. Please note the RNIB version of that book is read by Ray Sawyer.
So we proceeded to do the number one dates, something my father would have given his right arm for. Why he wanted to do a one-armed act, I never knew. Sorry, I'll do that again. So we proceed to do the number one dates, something my father would have given his right arm for. Why he wanted to do... So sorry.
We've actually got it. You don't have to go back over if you don't want to.
Well, I'll just do it once for the...
All right, okay.
So we proceeded to do the number one dates, something my father would have given his right arm for. Why he wanted to do a one-armed act, I'll never know.
The final and seventh volume of Spike Milligan's War Diaries is Piecework.
Home.
Can we have the title again? Because we didn't record it that time. We were just taking the level. So can we have the title written and read
them? Amazing news, folks. Piecework. Written and read by Spike Milligan.
which see our hero returning from war and to Italy. But to what? Aside from shooting large, inaccurate guns at Germans, all he's done for 5 long years is blow a trumpet, tell rude jokes, and write and perform sketches for the entertainment of bored and murderous soldiers. Who on earth is going to pay a civilian to do more of that? Through piecework, Spike makes his way through the backwaters of showbiz, meeting Harry Secombe, Michael Bentine, and Peter Sellers, who decide to call themselves the Goons.
Indeed, we won the war, but I lost 5 precious years. I was to mourn, and still do, the physical breakup of my family. It was a sort of time warp, Belson. As my ship left Naples Harbour, it was the cool end of autumn. The year, 1946. Time, like the ship, was slipping away. An azure twilight glazed the Campania. Lights enumerated along the seemingly timeless shore. Now lifeless, Vesuvius was turning into a faded amber silhouette. I stood aft on the promenade deck. Seamen still fussed around the ship's limits. The other passengers leaned out at the rail. I watched the oncoming pollution as they tossed their cigarettes into the sea. Goodbye.
Normally, after about an hour or two's working, you say, come on, let's have a tea break. And we said that to Spike, and he'd go, no, no, lads, you go off, you have a cup of tea, leave me alone. And he just wanted to be left alone.
Very nice. I will have a cup of tea in about an hour's time.
OK, fine.
Are you all right?
Thank you. You are the only person who's ever asked us that. I'm serious.
Luckily, there was a piano in the studio, so what he would do is at break times, he would just take about 10 or 15 minutes and play the piano.
Did you record any of that?
No, no, we didn't. In fact, we had the sound turned down. But, you know, to give him privacy. Mm. So we could see him. It was like watching a mime artist. We could see this man playing piano, but we couldn't hear him. But after about 2 or 3 sessions, we did get him like a little wild animal. We got him to take a lemon tea and a rich tea biscuit from us. By about year 5, I think he would start telling us anecdotes around the dinner table. At tea time. But if you ever watched Russell Harty or Michael Parkinson, they were the same stories. He would tell us the same stories that he regurgitated on TV. We never really felt like we knew him.
Yes, I want a non-cliched conversation. Good morning, Captain. Like to join me for a 9-a-side porridge? Good, better get your knee clips and quaffle spoons. Or would you rather twosome with cronk plates? There must be something wrong with me.
Can you stop a second?
Yeah, lovely.
Can you stop a second?